Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, July 25, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to have with us two experts today. One of them might be a surprise to you. I think we had some technical difficulties with our promotional materials today, so we are joined by one person you're expecting and one person you're perhaps not expecting. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of our two experts in turn of about 10 minutes, maybe some back and forth, but as always, questions from the audience. So please do be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the program. We'll hear first from Professor Jason Johnston. He's at the UVA School of Law, where he is the Henry L. and Grace Doherty Charitable Foundation Professor. He comes to us substituting for Todd Zawicki. He's Professor Zawicki's co-author on a critique of a CFPB study that he'll talk to us about. We'll hear remarks from him, followed by Thaddeus King. He is an officer at the consumer banking at the Pew Charitable Trusts. With that, Professor Johnston, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. What I thought I would do with my very brief remarks today is two things. First, just describe the CFPB's May 2016 proposed rule and some on the background of that rule. And then I will, in the remainder of my remarks, pretty much just critique the proposed rule and its basis. So anyway, in May 2016, the CFPB issued a proposed rule that would, I believe most importantly, ban arbitration clauses in consumer financial contracts that prohibit consumers from filing or joining a class action against the financial services provider. So that the rule does a few other things, but that is the most important thing. The rule is authorized under a couple provisions of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010. One section, 1028 of that, told the CFPB to study arbitration clauses and then authorize the CFPB to prohibit or impose conditions or limitations on the use of such clauses if the study that it did supported such actions. And the CFPB did do such a study. Originally, a draft came out in 2013. Then in March 2015, the final version of the CFPB's arbitration study was released. So it's that March 2015 arbitration study that provides the primary basis, factual basis, for this recently proposed ban on arbitration clauses by the CFPB. I should also say that the proposed rule has, in addition to obvious reliance on findings in the March 2015 study, the proposed rule also makes a bunch of assertions and about arbitration and class actions based on a congeries of sort of economic theory and evidence, and I will briefly discuss things that are in just the proposed rule and not in the 2015 study. But the bottom line for the justification for the proposed ban really can be stated pretty simply. The CFPB thinks that arbitration is not an effective way of addressing small claims consumer disputes. Small claims are hard to define, but say less than $1,000 at dispute, whereas class actions are, and the CFPB believes its evidence from the 2015 study and other sort of anecdotal evidence that it discusses in the proposed rule show that class actions are very effective and that if you don't allow class actions, consumers will not be compensated and wrongful behavior by firms will not be deterred, hence the rule. Now, I think that the evidence in the CFPB's own 2015 study shows that arbitration is actually very effective. It's not used perhaps as frequently as one might like, but it's effective when it is used. Whereas class actions, the evidence in the CFPB's 2015 study is really a lot more complicated than the CFPB thinks. Class actions are not such a wonderful mechanism of either compensation or deterrence as the CFPB thinks. And I myself have got independently done a study and am in the midst of a big study of consumer class actions filed in the Northern District, Illinois, over basically the same period studied by the CFPB. And what the CFPB says about class actions is at best only part of the story, and I'll try to highlight why I think that today. So the first thing to recognize is the CFPB's proposed rulemaking has, as did the 2015 study and press reports and political statements based on the 2015 study, has continued to stress a completely invalid and misleading comparison between class action settlements and arbitral awards. Arbitral awards are like a damage award by a jury or a judge. Settlements are settlements. You cannot compare class action settlements with arbitral awards. But the CFPB's 2015 study presented data that suggests such a comparison, and in that comparison you find that millions of consumers got about $1.1 billion in cash compensation from class action settlements, and only 32 consumers got damage awards from AAA, that is to say American Arbitration Association arbitrations. But of course that's just wrong. You don't compare settlements with awards. What the CFPB should have stressed is that 57% of the consumer arbitrations it studied, the consumers either were known to have gotten a settlement or likely to have gotten a settlement. And that's a pretty good rate. That's comparable to what you would find in any kind of class litigation, even if you include individual settlements as well as class settlements. So if you add the 6% of the time that consumers actually won, 63% of the time consumers won an arbitration. When they did win an arbitration, they got on average $5,400 in terms of the arbitrator's award. The CFPB itself said that AAA arbitration is cheap, effective, that you don't the consumers often, more often than not, do have counsel, but they don't need counsel. AAA arbitrations are resolved over the phone many times. If they're not resolved over the phone, they're resolved just on the basis of the documents, and they're resolved within 5 months. That is not what happens in class action settlements, which take years typically to be finalized and actually generate any compensation at all for consumers. And now it is true that these class actions the CFPB looked at, many of them did involve small dollar disputes, and consumers got on average $32. Actually, that's an overstatement. It's an overstatement that consumers got $32 in the class actions the CFPB reported on, but you have to understand, and this is true about the proposed rule, that the overdraft fee class action litigations, those were a number of class actions that were consolidated and settled, those made up an enormous fraction of the total class payments that the CFPB studied. And if you take out these gigantic settlement in the overdraft, well, actually it's many settlements in the overdraft fee class action litigations, what you're left with is that 6 million consumers shared $85 million in cash compensation. And so aside from the overdraft fee litigations, consumers got $14 each in these class action settlements. So 32 is actually an overstatement of what consumers get in class action settlements. In any event, the CFPB's 2015, March 2015 study reported some really positive things about arbitration. The only thing you can say about arbitration that isn't positive from that March 2015 study is there don't seem to be that many arbitrations, and there don't seem to be that many arbitrations in particular that involve small dollar claims, say less than $1,000 per consumer or less than $500. Well, when you really look through the data and the kind of cases, it's hard to tell exactly what the CFPB was looking at. Unlike the study that I'm conducting, they don't break out arbitrations by the type of substantive claim and with great detail and tell you the results by type of claim, that is to say, common law, federal consumer protection statute, state consumer protection statute. They don't provide a lot of data on arbitration. But give the CFPB the benefit of the doubt, and all they've shown is that there aren't that many arbitrations and not many for really small dollars. Now, one reason for that is a huge fraction of the arbitration study, just like a huge fraction of consumer class actions in federal court, involve statutory claims under, for example, federal consumer protection statutes, such as the Fair Credit Reporting Act or the Fair Debt Collection Practice Act or the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. All of these award statutory damages. I've looked at hundreds and hundreds of these complaints in federal court, and consumers always ask for statutory damages, which are $500 or $1,000. So automatically, lots of these arbitrations, because they're under these kind of statutes, are not small damage. So we don't even really know how many small damage claims there really are in arbitration. But even more important point here is that even if you grant that there aren't very many small dollar arbitrations, that doesn't say that arbitration is an ineffective means of redressing such claims. All it says is there aren't very many small dollar arbitrations. And you wouldn't expect there to be a lot of small dollar arbitrations because most of those involve things like fees or charges. And firms have a very strong incentive to resolve those kind of disputes internally. We know that. For the critique I did with Todd Zwicky back in 2015, we had data from a medium-sized bank in Texas showing that between 70 and 90% of the time, when consumers complain about fees for things like wire transfers and inactive accounts, they refund the fee. And this is consistent with everything we know. Actually, this was consistent with a big body of literature in economics and management telling firms that they should do this. They have to categorize consumers and, try to keep consumers happy. That's part of the business. Now, the CFPB recognizes that. They responded to that point that Todd and I made back in our critique. And they say, well, consumers, all the banks and other financial firms do is they're nice to the consumers who are profitable. They make these decisions solely on the basis of profitability. Well, the thing the CFPB doesn't realize is the profitability of a consumer highly correlates with how often a consumer generates fees. And moreover, if a bank or a financial firm is forced to do certain things with respect to unprofitable consumers, that is consumers whom they lose money on, they will start to take steps to try to make sure that they do not have those people as consumers in the first place. This is true even of the overdraft fee litigation that the CFPB repeatedly refers to. I think it is fair to say of the proposed rule, the May 2016 proposed rule, that the primary actual data point, aside from anecdotal things the CFPB has, the primary actual data point they have in to support both the value of class actions as both instruments of compensation and supposedly behavior change is the overdraft fee class action settlements. Now, that involved a situation where over time, because banks lose a lot of money on checking accounts, and many checking accounts are a real money loser, they tried to figure out a way to make checking accounts not such a money loser for them, and they decided to come up with a different way of processing checks and debits for purposes of determining whether there was an overdraft, and under that method, they paid the biggest checks first. Now, that did cause, there was the allegation by the plaintiffs. Again, this was never resolved on the merits. This is a big class action settlement. But the plaintiffs alleged this systematically generated higher overdraft fees. Well, whether it did or didn't, the CFPB in this proposed rule never asked whether consumers are better off by virtue of the firms stopping that practice. All the CFPB said is that the class counsel in that overdraft fee litigation wrote a law review article, and they said, yeah, because of this, a lot of banks stopped processing checks in that order, and they lowered the overdraft fees. But that is not the end of the story from an economic public policy point of view. And again, for the CFPB to do this under the Dodd-Frank Act, the statutory language, the governing statutory language requires that whatever the CFPB did had to be in the public interest and the protection of consumers. Whether it's for the protection of consumers depends not just on the direct effect, which will maybe to lower the amount of fees paid by consumers, but the indirect effects too. How many consumers have checking accounts? What's it done to the profitability of checking accounts for banks? has which consumers are better off and which consumers are worse off by virtue of this change in overdraft fees, even granting that the change was effectuated by virtue of these the big class action settlements. I mean, banks have said, admittedly without systematic evidence introduced into the record, that a lot of consumers would like to have their big checks for credit card bills and mortgages paid through first. Whether that's, it certainly seems plausible, regardless of whether there's systematic evidence. In any event, the CFPB places enormous weight on this single big settlement to show that class actions, in fact, have a positive, have a positive impact and are really good at compensating consumers and deterring wrongful behavior in these small disputes type cases. Now, you know, they may be right. It may be that class actions do better than I've been able to find out so far, or anybody else has been able to find out so far. In my own study of consumer class actions under federal consumer protection statutes so far, you know, usually 12%, maybe 15% of consumers are compensated. It depends on the type of statutory claim being brought. There are some particular statutory claims, some under the Fair Debt Collection Practice Act, where the compensation rate, the fraction of the class that actually gets money, is higher, say 35%, 40%, but that's not typical. Usually a very small fraction of the class is compensated. And again, the overdraft fee class action litigation is very unusual because it was very easy to just process money right back into the accounts of class members. That is not the typical. That is just far, far, far from the typical class action settlement. So in short, I guess I'd have to say, what does the CFPB have? Based on its 2015 study. It's got evidence that arbitration works really well, but isn't invoked that often, especially for small dollar disputes. It's got evidence that there were a few pretty successful big class action settlements. It has no explanation for the volume up or down of small dollar disputes, either in class action or arbitration. And by the way, the CFPB did not try to compare the actual number of small dollar disputes in class actions. I'm doing that, and I can tell you based on what we found so far, class actions involving small dollar disputes, such as small fees or charges cases, are very rare in the universe of class actions filed in federal court. When we get that data, we'll be able to compare that with what we see in AAA arbitration. But my point is, evidence that arbitration is pretty good, a few class actions that were pretty successful, no theory or data on why there should be what the number of small dollar disputes indicates about anything. And then on the basis of that, the CFPB has concluded that an actual ban on arbitration is for the protection of consumers. Well, I can think of a lot of things the CFPB should have considered but didn't, short of a ban. Maybe the CFPB should have taken the best arbitration clauses, such as those used by companies like Arbitration and Verizon, which guarantee consumers respectively $10,000 and $7,500 if the company makes an offer and the arbitrator decides on an award bigger than the company's offer, that consumers get these big liquidated damage awards. Those are great clauses. They shift all the fees over to the company. They give the consumers liquidated damages. Maybe the CFPB should have done something to advertise to companies these good kinds of arbitration clauses and cause them to become more frequent. There are a lot of other things the CFPB could have considered, guidelines for drafting arbitration clauses, all things that would have made arbitration even more effective than it already is. So the odd thing about the proposed rule, the 2016 proposed rule, doesn't even consider alternatives. Just says, well, we're going to ban arbitration, and given the existing state of the evidence, there just isn't evidence to do that. And I will turn that back over to Dean now.
Very good. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. With that, let's hear from our other speaker, opening remarks. Mr. King.
Hi. Hi, my name is Thaddeus King. I work at the Pew Charitable Trust, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, data-driven research institution in Washington, D.C. and I'm very happy to be able to speak with you today. If you would like to see any of our research on this topic or other topics, you can find it at our website, pewtrust.org. So I want to start by taking a step back and just giving an overview of how arbitration has worked over the past 80 years and how it has turned into something different in the past couple of decades. The Federal Arbitration Act was passed in 1925 when there were a lot of arbitration agreements between businesses that the court looked disfavorably upon. And for a long time, consumer arbitration agreements didn't really exist. However, in the past couple of decades, they've become very, very prevalent. We have done a lot of research on checking accounts and prepaid cards, which I think are two very good examples of this. And we found that there's a growing number of firms that are including these arbitration agreements to the point where there are some markets where almost every single agreement in a market will have, such as prepaid cards, will have an arbitration agreement. So if consumers were to want to avoid an arbitration agreement, many times they just simply would not be able to. Second, to talk about arbitration, arbitrations do not really happen, and they do not happen at all for small claims. The number of small claims that are dealt with in arbitration is only a handful per year when you're talking about arbitrations for under $1,000, which makes these figures a bit misleading, where arbitrations that do happen result in much larger awards, whereas when there are small claims against companies, they just simply aren't arbitrated and there's no award at all. And I do think it's interesting that Professor Johnson brought up the checking account issue. It's another area that we've studied a lot, and I don't want to harp on it for too long. But it's a great example of how the class action system has benefited consumers. With the case of an overdraft, there are a number of problems with what Professor Johnson said. First, as he admitted, you know, it's unlikely that a person would go to court over a small amount. That's borne out by the facts. A person who has a $35 fee, it's very unlikely to go to court. In fact, when we surveyed consumers, less than 20% said that they would go to court if they'd been charged a fee. A small fee over and over again. And that's simply what they say they would do. The research that the CFPB has done shows that that's even an optimistic number. Most consumers, the very most that they would do would be to talk to a manager or to maybe close their account. And what Professor Johnson says that doesn't that needs to be explained is oftentimes, consumers don't know that the law has been broken. They don't know that there is a deceptive fee for overdraft. They have no way of knowing that reordering transactions might be an illegal activity, which the California District Court in Gutierrez v. Wells Fargo did find that that was against the law, and that was upheld, and certiorari was denied, so that case was concluded, finding that the Wells Fargo had been deceptive. But the other thing that's important to know is maybe a bank will provide a refund for any customers that want a refund, as Professor Johnson said. But most customers aren't going to even complain to the bank for a fee, especially if they don't know that the fee was taken unlawfully. So a class action would act to hold the bank accountable for the fees that are charged to all consumers, not simply those who choose to complain. So getting back to the reasoning of the rule, the bottom line is that arbitrations related to clauses to these pre-dispute arbitration agreements. They don't happen. It's the total number is in the hundreds. The number for the types of claims that could be brought as class actions, these repeated small amount claims, such as the overdraft or, you know, often the statutory damages as well, they simply don't happen. It's not valuable for anyone involved to go forward with these. The only reasonable way to hold financial companies responsible is through class action. And another point I would like to make would be the point about how in the overdraft case was an exception with the ability to automatically put funds into a consumer's account. So for a lot of arbitrations or class action lawsuits in other areas of commerce, there can be a lot of difficulty with inability to actually pay the people who are harmed in the class action. However, both now and especially moving forward with digital payments being more and more the norm, when there is a harm to a class of people, it should be easier and easier for consumers to be paid because the bank or other company will have their financial account information and can make those payments automatically and electronically. So to conclude, I would like to note that the survey that we conducted in 2015 had very, very broad across-the-board support from all political affiliations and demographics. And what it found was that people think that taking legal action for small harms is just not worth the time and it's not worth the money. The CFPB has shown in a study that it's just not reasonable to expect people to take action for these small fees. And further, that consumers, while they don't actually believe that they would go to court, they do not want their rights to be taken away. An arbitration agreement that keeps you from going to court takes away one of your constitutional rights, and it was a very strong step by the Congress in 2010 to allow the CFPB to do this study to restore people's rights to go to court, and that view is shared by the vast majority of all people across all demographics. So I'd be happy to take any questions on this, and I'll turn it back over to Dean.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. I want to give Professor Johnson a chance to expand his remarks and maybe respond a little bit. Before I do that, let's open the queue to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. If you joined us late, we've got a change in our program today from what was promoted originally. We're joined by Thaddeus King, as anticipated, but by Professor Jason Johnson of the UVA Law School instead of Professor Todd Zawicki. We've had opening remarks from both. I want to hear back from Professor Johnson, give him a chance to respond, and also maybe say a little bit about a little bit more about the statute with which authorized this study. You know, it seems to me there's been a pretty strong history of Congress encouraging arbitration, even maybe sometimes requiring it or preferring it. How clear was Congress in, I guess it was Dodd-Frank, in calling for this study and delegating authority to the CFPB to regulate?
Thanks, Dean. This is Jason Johnston from UVA. I'll respond to a couple points made by Thaddeus and then talk a little bit about congressional policy toward arbitration. 2 points that Mr. King made. You know, there was a survey done by the CFPB back in 2015, and it showed that very few consumers would talk to a lawyer or even think about anything like that if a bank if a credit card company refused to refund a fee that had been incorrectly, in the consumer's view, assessed against their account. But 60% of the consumers said what they would do is close the account and take their business elsewhere. That is the market incentive for companies to do this. That is why companies respond to these things, and they forgive fees and charges, and they forgive fees and charges almost all the time for their best customers who do not generate high costs and do not continually generate fees and charges. Customers who generate very high costs really could be described as opportunistic customers who are simply not even close to being profitable for the bank or the credit card company, and they have to ask at some point whether they're going to be left holding a large uncollectible debt from these kind of customers. And the fees and charges that are assessed are a way for banks to flag that and signal that, and credit card companies, and try to avoid that problem. But certainly they have every incentive to try to avoid it by renegotiating. We know that happens with credit cards all the time. So in any event, that's what consumers do. They invoke what we would call a market sanction, not their legal sanction, not arbitration or class actions. And it's continually, Director Cordray uses this kind of language too, talking about consumers had a right to go to court and they lost their right to go to court. In the CFPB's study and my study, even in the CFPB's study of class actions, you have less than 1% of the cases that ever end up in any kind of judgment. In my study of consumer class actions filed in the Northern District of Illinois over 2010 to 2012, zero cases, I can repeat that, zero cases involve anybody going to court, getting a bench trial or a jury trial, and actually going to court and getting their rights adjudicated. There are cases decided on summary judgment. There are cases decided on 12b-6. There are legal decisions sometimes being made, but nobody gets a judgment on the merits. We have the consumer cases we have where consumers want are all default judgments against defendants who are essentially either non-existent or soon to be non-existent. So there are a lot of myths about class actions, and that's the problem. You can't compare a reality or a hypothesized reality about arbitration, because we really don't know as much as we should, against mythologized class actions. You've got to compare the real thing against the real thing. Now, as far as congressional policy goes, in the Federal Arbitration Act, Congress set forth a very clear policy in favor of arbitration in a number of high-level cases that we all know about over the past 5 or 6 years, such as AT&T versus Concepcion and the Italian Colors case. The Supreme Court consistently stated that, in passing the Federal Arbitration Act, Congress did mean to preempt state laws that would disfavor any kind of state law that would disfavor arbitration clauses, and struck down various decisions by the California Supreme Court that it thought was trying to do so. So you've got that in the Federal Arbitration Act, and then under Dodd-Frank, the CFPB was told to do this study of arbitration, which it did, and then authorized to either prohibit or impose conditions or limitations on arbitration clauses, but only if it was found it was in the public interest and for the protection of consumers. And in my view, it's beyond imagining that the record that exists now could possibly support a finding that a ban on arbitration is in the public interest and for protection of consumers. We just don't really know. It could be that the arbitration ban is exactly not in the public interest and for the protection of consumers. So given that the Federal Arbitration Act is out there, it seems to me one can at least argue that that language in Dodd-Frank has to be read with the background of the strong congressional policy in favor of arbitration, meaning the CFPB really has to have evidence to support this ban. I'll turn it back to Dean.
Thank you so much, Professor. Once again, if you have a question, press the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have one caller question, two questions. Now, I'll give Mr. King a chance to answer this first question if it's directed to him, and also maybe get a bit of his own rebuttal in. Let's take our first call now.
Yeah, I have a question about the basic assumption of the CFPB, which seems to be that there is currently under enforcement of the law. They look upon a low number of arbitrations as a sign that people aren't getting their rights enforced. An equally plausible conclusion is that in general, consumers are reasonably happy with the service that they are getting. Yet the CFPB seems to be going forward on the assumption that that one reason to ban the arbitration without class actions is that we really need more enforcement because there are a lot of really bad actors out there. And I'm wondering if there is anything in the statute itself that suggested that that was Congress's intent, that it really wanted to increase the overall amount of enforcement, or is there more, is the indication simply that Congress wanted to ensure that those consumers who did have concerns would have an adequate means of getting redress?
Let's give Mr. King a chance to take that.
Sure. I will say that the complaint database that the CFPB hosts would indicate that there are many, many, many consumers who are, you know, upset about their treatment as consumers by financial companies. Now, of course, the complaint database is not proof that any laws have been broken, but it would suggest that there are plenty of consumers who are not happy. Congress's intent was, I mean, they gave the CFPB, you know, there have been many cases in the past a few decades where Congress has explicitly curbed the FAA and has said that it doesn't apply. So, for example, in the Military Lending Act bans arbitration agreements wholesale for credit contracts with members of the military. I believe there are some other instances with the SEC as well, and FINRA. I'm not as up to speed on the non-consumer issues, but I believe that it's, you know, what they said was very clear, that they needed to base any sort of ban on what was in the public interest and for the protection of consumers. I believe the CFPB did a good job in its rule and its explanation of breaking down both of those elements separately, which I thought was an interesting choice. They could have grouped them together as one idea, but they broke them out separately. And if you read the preamble to the proposed rule, you'll see that they definitely lay out a very solid line of reasoning for why banning arbitration agreements that prevent class actions is in the public interest and for the protection of consumers, based on the ability to have redress for harms, but equally importantly, to prevent bad behavior. And I think it's, you know, talking about economic theory, it's definitely, if you have a chance, if you're breaking the law, to have to face massive consequences for doing so, you are more likely, it is a rational move to try to ensure, to spend more time and more resources making sure that you're not going to break those laws and end up on the wrong side of a judgment. And now, of course, it is true that just like most cases of all types, class actions very rarely end up with a, you know, a judge reading a verdict against one individual or the other. They're almost always settled or dismissed, or, you know, how all court cases end up with that as the conclusion. But they do act as a deterrent. It only makes sense that if you have to face consequences, you're more likely to spend more resources on compliance. So, and that would seem to be something that would, in the end, benefit consumers.
Professor Johnson, before we go to the next question, do you have anything on this?
Yeah, if I could, just a few kind of response to that. Look, the complaint database that the CFPB has is seriously flawed. The CFPB does not take all kinds of consumer communications and put them in the complaint database. Only things that the CFPB finds to be properly categorized as complaints, meaning negative, go in there. And that's an entirely different issue, whether that complaint database is the sort of thing that gives you an accurate picture of what consumers are actually aware of or worried about or concerned about and unhappy about. The other thing is, this is entirely conjectural that class actions have this deterrent effect. Class actions and any kind of potential ex post liability has a deterrent effect if you know and there's a clear line between what's wrong and what's not wrong. The overdraft fee litigation, when you look at what that district judge did in San Francisco, he had a very difficult time with preemption issues there because the argument was, you know, you can't tell the banks to that what they did was wrong when, in fact, under federal regulations, it wasn't wrong. So he said, well, actually, under the State Consumer Protection Act, this is false and deceptive. Well, an ex post decision by one judge that a particular practice was false and deceptive is hardly evidence that this is something everybody knew was false and deceptive. I think it'd be wonderful if the CFPB surveyed consumers and asked them, well, how do you think a bank ordered the checks? Do you think they always ordered it low to high or chronologically as they came in that day? I don't know what consumers would have said, but it's far from the case that this was a sort of bad behavior that we clearly wanted to deter. It was a kind of behavior that a particular federal judge in a particular court found after the fact to be false and deceptive. That's all that was. And, you know, there's just not a basis for this rule. I mean, if you look at the proposed rule, it makes these amazing assertions, such as consumers are unaware they've suffered harm. And how do we know consumers are unaware they've suffered harm? Over 300,000 people signed an online petition 5 years ago when Bank of America thought they proposed slapping a fee on the use of debit cards. 300,000 people found out about that within a matter of hours and got online to protest. And the CEO of Bank of America, Moynihan, a few days later, of course, B of A rescinded the fee. And he said, yeah, that was one of the reasons that we did it is because we lost. We had 20% of our accounts closed within 48 hours after the fee was proposed. So it may have been true back in 1970, which is kind of the vintage of most of our consumer protection statutes, that consumers didn't know what was going on and were unaware and couldn't communicate with each other. But that's not true now, not in 2016. What the CFPB has done here is something that you would have expected somebody regulator to do in 1975, not 2016. This is old age 20th century regulation.
Once again, this is Dean Reuter. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got two questions pending, so let's continue to work through these calls.
This is Brian Fitzpatrick at Vanderbilt Law School. I've read some of Professor Johnson's work, and I've worked with Mr. King on some projects at the Pew Center, and I just want to first say thank you to both of them for taking the time to do this, and I think both of them do very high-quality work, and so it's a great privilege to have their time today. I do have a couple of questions for Professor Johnson. Your frequent invocation of the market being able to take care of these problems on its own makes me wonder whether you think it would be okay if companies simply asked their customers to sign contracts that didn't let them sue the companies at all. If the market works so well to resolve deceptive and fraudulent practices, then don't we have no need for lawsuits or arbitration altogether? Let the consumers just close their accounts, and that should take care of it. So I'm curious, number one, if you just think it's okay for companies just to ask their customers to not sue them for any disputes altogether. Number two, the way this has been kind of set up today is a dilemma between arbitration and court. But I really don't see the CFPB rulemaking as presenting that question. To me, the rule is really about the class mechanism or not the class mechanism. I have nothing against arbitration. I think, you know, the American litigation system has a lot of dysfunctions, and I think people ought to be encouraged to come up with different procedural rules to make litigation more sensible. And the CFPB doesn't prevent people from going to arbitration so long as a class device is still available in the arbitration. At least that's my understanding. And so I guess my question to Professor Johnson is, what's so bad about that? If you think that companies should not be able to just absolve themselves from being sued altogether, what's so bad with letting them go to arbitration still, but asking them to preserve the class-wide device in the arbitration?
May I respond? Dean?
Yes, please.
Oh, okay.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, this is Jay. Okay, responding to Professor Fitzpatrick's questions, and I'm aware of your work, of course, as you know, Professor Fitzpatrick, and a great admirer of your work, and I've learned a lot from it, so I appreciate your questions. The main thing I think of, the way you have to think of arbitration is as something that complements the firm's own incentives to invest in internal dispute resolution. I'll be publishing or putting out pretty shortly with the Manhattan Institute a paper that really kind of explains the relationship between different kinds of ex post dispute resolution, that is class actions versus arbitration, and a firm's incentives to invest in internal dispute resolution mechanisms. And the key thing is, and this really kind of goes to both questions, that if you've got a relatively random method of ex post dispute resolution, which can attach enormous liability to a firm through class action settlements for behavior that could never have been predicted and, in the opinion of most people, would not have been wrong, let alone fraudulent or deceptive, then that really creates bad incentives for firms. It creates bad incentives for them in determining which accounts to take on in the first place, how much to invest to prevent mistakes from occurring, and then how much to invest in internal dispute resolution mechanisms where they decide whether to waive or a fee or charge. So the problem with class mechanisms of any kind, and admittedly this would probably be less bad in arbitration than in the court system, that is a class arbitration, is the cost and the randomness. Now, if you don't get rid of the cost problem, and I think this is the concern with class arbitration, you're still going to have an incentive for firms to settle disputes ex post simply to avoid costs. And it's very difficult to see how you would design a class arbitration mechanism, excuse me, that didn't get involved some of the really big costs that you have with class actions in litigation. And I think the Supreme Court has said that on several different occasions. And that is the problem with class arbitration. The problem, again, should consumers be able to sign away all their rights? Well, you know, in theory, like in tort law, in most states, we allow consumers or people who go to use a ski resort or something to waive away their right to sign away their right to sue for negligence. And in a sense, that's kind of appealing to me and the financial services. But the problem is, what's negligence, what's not? How can you resolve these things? And the great virtue of arbitration of individualized disputes, and this is the great sadness of the CFPB's report too, is it could have provided insight for us into the accuracy of arbitration. And this is something I'm trying to get at rather indirectly now. The accuracy meaning, you know, an arbitrator looks at the contract that a credit card company or a bank has with the consumer, and all of those contracts, as I've said in previous work, are written so that the firms have enormous discretion. They don't have an absolute clear obligation to impose a fee or charge or take a whole bunch of other actions. They have discretion to take those actions, and the reason they have discretion to take those actions is so that they can take the action that best furthers their relationship with the customer. This is why the contracts are written the way they are, and these are the contracts that arbitrators then see and are arbitrating, and they're determining a consumer's rights under those contracts. When you get into court in a class action context and have the prospect of a jury or even a judge who would maybe not pay as much attention to those contracts as should be paid, they start asking abstract questions. Well, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Is this a fair thing or a not fair thing? I've talked to congressional staffers and had staffers raise examples of fees and charges they paid, and my question to them always is, well, what did the contract say? Did the firm have a right to assess it? And more often than not, they say, yeah, they did, but I still didn't like paying it. Well, that doesn't matter. That's the way these contracts are written, and they're written the way they are for really good economic reasons that make all consumers better off. And, you know, it's for that reason that preserving arbitration as an ex post dispute resolution mechanism is the way to go. I don't think, you know, it's just too difficult to say that there's no dispute that a consumer should ever be able to bring against the company. I haven't gone that far, and I don't think anybody's gone that far. And my belief in the effectiveness of market mechanisms and market incentives is not antithetical to arbitration. Arbitration complements those incentives. That's what's so important about it. I'll hand it back to Dean.
Thank you. We've got about 8 minutes left, one question pending, so let's see if we can get through this final caller here.
Hey, how's it going? This is Hayden O'Byrne in Miami. You're just hearing you guys talk. The most, you know, I guess the most important thing that pops out to me, and I guess the CFPB, and I don't know if they looked at this, is that class plaintiffs, when they settle a consumer class action, almost always select arbitration. And that's because it's the claims process. You know, at the end of the day, any plaintiff in any class action is going to have to submit evidence of some sort to a neutral person who decides how much money they get. And the whole idea that, you know, arbitration is off the table is just ridiculous to me, because it's going to come right back in with a class settlement. And that arbitration or claims process is probably going to be worse off to the consumer because it's a negotiated settlement. It's probably going to cut off their claims early. It's probably going to require all sorts of proof that it's going to be difficult and expensive for a plaintiff to come up with, because at the end of the day, they still have the burden of proof. And the only difference is that somebody's going to walk away with a large amount of attorney's fees and say, rah, 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 we've done this great service. But at the end of the day, it's really done nothing for the consumer in terms of shortening the decision-making process. And I'd like to know if the CFPB, you know, when they're banning arbitrations, are going to ban it in settlements. And if so, who is going to actually adjudicate all these $20 claims? Because I can't imagine many federal judges are going to allow a procession of plaintiffs to come into their courtroom over $20 trials.
Sounds like a question in the first instance for Mr. King. And as you respond to this, Mr. King, let's get your final thought, and then we'll hear finally from Professor Johnston.
Okay. So the CFPB's rule does not prohibit arbitrations. It prohibits a requirement to go to arbitration before the dispute arises. Interestingly, when the CFPB held a field hearing in Newark a couple years back, when they released the study, one of the witnesses was from a credit union, and said that they had used arbitration to settle all the disputes that they had with their members in the past few years, but they had agreed to arbitration after the fact. And that's really kind of dovetails nicely back into my final point, which is that the arbitration agreements are only about the class action bans. And the evidence suggests that this is true. First of all, when you look at agreements that have arbitration clauses in them, they all pretty much contain a class action ban. There are often other parts of the agreements that will vary from contract to contract, but the one thing that you pretty much always see is the class action ban. And banks do not show much of resolve about using arbitration except for to avoid class action losses. When you look at a lot of these contracts include exemptions for small claims. Now, of course, a class action is very unlikely to be a small claim, and I believe that you can't actually go to small claims court with a class action. But a lot of them will just say that any claim under X dollars, perhaps it's $10,000 or so, can go forward in court. What that does is it pretty much allows any person who has an individual claim, except for some that may be very large, to go to court with their claim. Also, they commonly or somewhat commonly include opt-outs. And the reason that the opt-out can work is because very few people, perhaps some people who work in like this policy, such as myself, might actually send in a letter to a financial company to opt out. But the numbers are incredibly small. And again, they're not concerned about an individual court case. They only care about preventing the class action.
Now, a final word from Professor Johnston.
It is interesting. I'm looking at literally hundreds of class action, well, not hundreds, but about 100 probably total class action settlements in this Northern District of Illinois data set. And, yeah, when you get down to finalizing a class action settlement, there's got to be some mediator. And there are some district judges who are really active in getting mediators and arbitrators involved and getting the parties to figure out what the terms of the settlement actually are. So maybe the CFPB, I don't know what the CFPB would say about that. Maybe that should be banned too. If arbitration's so bad, I don't understand why we're allowing federal judges to use arbitrators and mediators to work out the terms of these class action settlements, but it happens all the time. But again, and the final point made there, it's really important that you have the class action. Why it's so important that arbitration clauses ban class actions is probably can be best understood by thinking, imagine there's a system of random liability where the bigger companies and the bigger you are, the higher the probability that you have to pay a whole lot of money in the form of a class action settlement to avoid endless e-discovery in order to dispose of these lawsuits where there's no underlying wrongful behavior. Suppose that's what class actions are, and I think the evidence is that they are, at least the evidence I'm getting, many of them, especially in these fees and charges cases. What kind of system is that, and what does that do to a company's incentives? It doesn't do anything good to the incentive of a company in terms of deciding how often and how many accounts to allow consumers to open. Doesn't do anything for a company's incentive determining how much to invest in internal dispute resolution mechanisms that make it the case that mistakes are corrected quickly and that consumers who hardly ever incur fees and charges don't have to pay them. It basically does exactly the opposite. It deters companies from getting into the businesses and extending product lines to consumers where there is a risk of these kind of lawsuits and potential liability. So that's why these clauses ban class actions.
Well, gentlemen, this is Dean Reuter. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. It's an interesting debate. Thank you both for your time and your thoughts today. To the audience, a reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be discussing the explosion in opioid use and some legal and policy matters about that. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.